So yeah, it's nice to be back, and thank you for the invitation. What I want to tell you about is some work that I've been doing with Andrei Frolov, who's a postdoc at Stanford, and my graduate student, Christian Christiansen. And what it concerns is the interior structure of charged black holes. So let me just start by reminding you of the geometry of a static, electrically charged Bryson-Nostrum black hole in four dimensions. It has an interesting global structure. So this is the metric in the coordinate system that works in the region outside the black hole, which is this diamond-shaped region here. In the this is the Penrose diagram that I've drawn there. Now you can extend through there, and the maximally extended space-time is this infinitely repeated structure with multiple asymptotic regions. It has time-like singularities and associated Cauchy horizons. And of course, these Cauchy horizons will present a problem for an initial value formulation of system in the space-time. And the similar problems come up in maybe the more physically relevant case of a rotating black hole. So sort of have in mind is to study this physics of these Cauchy horizons in the simplified context where we have spherical symmetry and so on and so forth. And the basic question that I want to address is to what extent this whole extended structure is physically relevant. It's a classical solution of the Einstein equations that assumes that we have vacuum except for the electric field. And there's some reasons to doubt the validity of this picture. In particular, it was realized a long time ago and has been sort of studied by a large number of people through the years, that there is something not quite innocuous about this region of the Cauchy horizon, and that it is a surface of infinite blue shift with respect to the outer horizon. And people worried that that might lead to some problems. In particular, if you have some perturbation in this exterior region which propagates inwards, then it'll be infinitely focused. As if you have, say, a time-like observer that's passing through this horizon, this incoming radiation will be infinitely focused near this surface. And so you might worry about the back reaction of this infinitely focused radiation on the geometry. And in fact, if you consider a more physical geometry than this static solution, if you think about the more dynamical situation of forming a charged black hole by collapse, you can expect, in fact, a stronger dynamical instability of this Cauchy horizon region, which has been dubbed mass inflation, and has been also has some history. It was first proposed or discussed in, by Poisson and Israel in mid-89-90, and then there's a long literature on that also. What I want to talk about today is a different. This is still at the classical level, this mass inflation problem. And basically, what very loosely described, if you have, in fact, in the original papers, what is studied is actually perturbations on top of this space-time here. And if you have some infalling matter on top of coming in here, and there's also some outgoing matter in this region here, and this is generically to be expected because there's curvature in this region, so there'll be backscattering. So you expect to have these cross flows. And when you, if you define, you can define locally a mass function in here, and what you find is that this mass function, when you have these cross flows present, will in fact diverge as you approach this. So that's this mass inflation that's talked about. But this is still classical physics. What I would
remind us, what's the meaning of that mass function?
Its definition is basically you generalize for a dynamical situation. You can define it in a fairly sensible way if you have spherical symmetry. like you have here. And it really is, for example, if you have incoming matter alone, then you can solve the thing by a Vaidya solution, and it is simply the mass that goes in there.
So it's sort of the amount of mass within the radius.
That's right.
And so somehow that, well, is still conserved, but in some funny way.
It's conserved. Basically, what's happening, if you think about spherical shells that are, you have one of them outgoing and the other ingoing, then it's the total mass of the system is clearly just given by Birkhoff's theorem is constant outside. But it is, on the one hand, the infalling shell is gathering mass by its being accelerated, gathering energy by being accelerated in the potential of the inner guy. And then as they cross, whereas the inner guy, of course, doesn't feel at all the outer guy, this is a very heuristic description of this. Then when they cross, you're still sort of the effect of the blue shift of the increase that is still carried by the impelling guy and the out guy goes out. So basically, when they cross, you the sum of the masses is still constant, but you basically transfer mass from the outgoing guy to the ingoing guy. And if this happens in the neighborhood of this surface here, when you look at the geometric, you do the geometry right, then what you find is that this mass transfer is actually is going to infinity here.
So there's infinite amount of mass
asymptotically
outside as well as inside,
so
some big inhomogeneity or something.
Right. I mean the reason also why this subject has a long literature is that it's very hard, and it's proved very hard to make definitive statements in a coordinate invariant way about what's going on there. I think that's been recently improved on.
Well, if Fermos, you kind of started
right
at the end of the list there,
right.
He has, I think, the best discussion of this, because he solves for the spherically symmetric scalar fields falling into this in this background.
Right.
And the claim is that the metric does have a, so it's not a test field, in other words, he's doing exact spherically symmetric collapse of gravity coupled to scalar. The metric is continuous across the inner quotient horizon, so it is C0, but it's not C1.
Okay. And so, I wasn't going to go into details about this because basically the effect that I want to talk about is different. It's a quantum effect, and it has to do with the pair creation in the electric field of the black hole. And so it's well known that if you have a background electric field, there's an amplitude for creating charged particles. Now this was worked out by Schwinger a long time ago. And at least in a weak field, the production rate per unit volume is given by a formula like this. It's a tunneling effect, so you have this exponential suppression here. So unless the electric field is quite strong, this is going to be suppressed by this exponential factor here. But in a field, when you get to a field of given by this critical field, this will be an effect where you will rapidly produce particles. Now, of course, an important observation then is that if we go back to this geometry here, since the electric field string goes like 1 over r, and r is going to 0 here, we do get, in the classical solution, arbitrarily large field. So it's clear that as you approach the singularity, this effect will be strong, and the assumption that you have just vacuum and not, and apart from the gauge field and the geometry, is going to be a bad assumption to make there. So what we want to do now is to include this pair creation effect and obtain sort of the back reaction, figure out its back reaction on the geometry. There will basically be a charged fluid that surrounds the singularity, and depending on the parameters, it will extend quite. In fact, if the parameters are adjusted in a way that this critical field is reached outside here, the black hole will discharge itself quite rapidly. And the most interesting range of parameters from my point of view is if this critical field occurs here in this region, that would be classically outside the inner horizon. So now if you try to do this in 3 plus 1 dimensional gravity, it turns out to be a rather hard problem. In particular, it was considered the first people that I know of that considered this question were Novikov and Starobinsky around 1980. And they made various approximations and concluded that, in fact, you should not expect the black hole to have an inner horizon, but that it should be removed by this effect, and that you would have just one outer horizon and then the space-like singularity site. Now, I'm going to study this in the context of a simplified two-dimensional model where you can study this much more explicitly than what they did, and I will come to the same conclusion at the end of the day. Now, another piece of work on this subject was by Herman and Hiscock in the mid-90s, where they laid, again, they made a lot of simplifying assumptions in order to be able to do analytic calculations. Basically, what they did was to consider the case where the critical field occurs in this region in between the inner and the outer horizon. And they made the so-called sudden approximation that this percolation rate can be completely ignored if your field is smaller than the critical field. And that is basically infinite, that you cannot have a larger field than this than the critical field. And then what they did basically was to argue that if you have this sudden approximation, then there can simply be no electric field inside, but basically that you will create so many particle pairs right away when you get to the critical field that they will completely neutralize the black hole charge. And so what their model actually is very simple. They simply patch together the outside Reisman-Nordström solution to an interior solution, which is Schwarzschild, and they patch it across the space-like surface here because this is happening inside the event horizon. And you can do this, and you can do it in a way that satisfies the junction condition. And they argue that this suggests rather strongly that this effect can change the global topology of the space. Okay. So we want to ask, want a more detailed picture than this. This ignores completely, for example, the stress energy of the particles that we create. And also the sudden approximation is you expect the percolation to set on even there's a gradual onset of it rather than a sudden. So one would like to do better. And as I said, it's a hard problem to solve in the full 3+1 dimensional case. And so what we will do is to consider a simpler model. It's a 1+1 dimensional model, which has classical black holes, charged black hole solutions that have, in fact, the same global topology. The Jess-Henrotz diagram will be identical to that of the Reisman-Nordström black hole.
Yes. I'm confused. So you've got pair production in the electric field inside the black hole.
Uh-huh.
But you don't have an asymptotic region. So where are the charges sort of going? Asymptotic? Or what's the...
Well, it's a funny model that they have. It's basically because they're patching across a space-like surface. There's a space-like current that's sort of taking them to the naively in the discussion that they have. And actually, I don't really want to go into much detail about that model because I think we can do a lot better in the 2D picture. But sort of what would happen if you were to think about, if you have the background Reisman-Nordström space, then you can ask if in this region, inside the outer horizon, what happens if you percolate? Well, one of the, then we'll go to one singularity, and the other one will go to the other, basically. And they will reduce the charge on those two reflected singularities.
If you're really reducing the charge, you've got to have some asymptotic creation of particles. You know, charging.
Well, there will be an ongoing current that's there, and that when the thing in a static solution will settle into a configuration where there is net charge density outside the, but you know the individual charges of course will not be stationary because they can't be. I think it's better if we just go into and see what happens when you can do this more systematically.
Well, okay. Good. Yeah, it sounds very puzzling, or at least I'm not.
But I agree that it's sort of quite, it's harder to have an intuition for how this works inside the horizon. But I, you know, the equations, I mean, the patching conditions are consistently solved in the model. That's not a, but of course, they do ignore the stress energy of the particles there, and they don't worry too much about the dynamics of the particles that they're creating. Okay, so here's the model. It'll be familiar to some of you. It's basically what we've done is to take a model which is 1 + 1-dimensional Dirac gravity, and we've added a gauge shield to it. We have the gauge shield in order to have black hole solutions that carry charge. Now, we're simply going to be studying this model in its own right as a toy model that exhibits the physical effect that we're interested in, but it does have some 3 + 1-dimensional pedigree in that it is the S-wave reduction of at least the Dirac gravity part of it is obtained if you take extremely charged magnetic black holes in 3 + 1-dimensional Dirac gravity and you focus on the S-waves in the near extreme region. This is, of course, that without the the gravitational hex sector here is the same as the so-called CGHS model, the Gibbs-Carving Schrödinger model. Then we've added the issue. Now, well, like I said, we're going to think of this primarily as just a one plus one dimensional model, but it's good to keep in mind this higher dimensional interpretation. In particular, this factor that comes out front here, e to the minus 2 phi, if you go back to the 3 + 1-dimensional description and you do the Wahl transformation to the Einstein frame, then you'll see that this is in fact the area of the transverse two-sphere in Wahl, which is useful to keep in mind. And another thing that sort of we see from here is that the gravitational coupling depends on this Dirac field here. And so the picture is that if our world goes from left to right, that it's weakly coupled on the left, and then the coupling sort of increases as you go right. And you think about that in the higher dimension, that on the right is the asymptotic region, and then you're going radially inwards in the 3 + 1-dimensional spherical course. Okay, there's a parameter here, lambda, and this is important, that we have a free parameter that sets our mass scale. That means we can, by choosing that, it allows us it argues that we can have classical and this mass scale is inherited from the higher dimensional theory. It is basically the inverse of the magnetic charge that's carried by the stream of black hole that we start with. Okay. This is unlike, for example, if you're doing 1 + 1-dimensional string theory, where the mass scale is always the string scale. It allows us to have a small mass scale. Okay. So here are the classical equations of motion of this model, and they have simple solutions. In particular, there's a two-parameter family of static solutions in this model, which are described. I'm using the so-called linear Dirac gauge. And so this makes it explicit what I was saying before. If x goes to infinity, that's when we have weakly coupled. Then when x goes to minus infinity, we have strong coupling. The gauge field is given by, if you recall what I just said about the area function, what you'll find is that this is exactly the behavior that you expect, that basically we're conserving the flux through the transverse two spheres. And then we have the metric, and it has this structure here that, and if I choose my mass to be larger than the charge in the appropriate units, I will have two zeros here, which gives me black hole solutions with both with the horizon. Okay. Now, and okay, I can now, this is again, it's a coordinate system that only applies outside the event horizon. The coordinates break down when I go there, but I can do exactly the same thing that you do in Fassner-Nordström. I can straightforward to find the extension that allows me to go inside, and then I can repeat that and I'm not going to go through that here, but basically at the end of the day, the maximal extension is again exactly the same repeated structure that we have in Rasmussen, and you get the identical tenor size. Therefore, you do have an inner Cauchy horizon. It is a surface of infinite blue shift. And about 10 years ago, people studied these models, or related models, and concluded that they also would exhibit this mass inflection instability at the classical level. So this seems like a good model to play with, in that it has the, at the classical level, it has the features that we want. Now, in order to see the Schwinger effect, we have to add some matter. So what we do is to couple this to Dirac fermions. And again, this is a generalization of a model that has been considered before. Basically, in back when we were studying the CGHS black holes and their relatives, we introduced what we call linear dilaton electrodynamics, sort of as a toy model of those toy models. And so that was basically taking this model that I have today and decoupling the gravity from it. We just assumed that you had linear dilaton on a flat space-time and studied the electrodynamics. And it turned out the electrodynamics had some parallels with the gravitational physics. In particular, you could form things that were the electromagnetic analogs of black holes, which then would actually, we had electromagnetic analogy of Hawking radiation, and then in this model, you could even resolve the information possible within two dimensions. But, so what we're doing, and that was and absolutely crucial in that whole story, was this speculation about and its relation to the chiral anomaly in this two-dimensional model. And we're going to, again, take advantage of that, but this time, things are complicated by the fact that we're coupled with gravity, so we will have black holes around. Okay. So the key to analyzing this is to, as I said, is to take advantage of this relation between the chiral anomaly and the precreation effect. And we're going to describe the quantum physics of this system of fermions coupled to gravity in terms of a dual description in terms of bosons. So we're going to bosonize this Dirac fermion. And so the basic formulas here are given here. And so long as we're not in a region of very strong curvature, we can carry out the bosonization. And what we'll get is this description here, with basically the action for the bosons is the will be the two-dimensional Schwinger model coupled to gravity.
When you say normal order, is that normal ordering with respect to some flat background metric?
Yeah, so it's...
It's not the black hole metric that you're...
These formulas here are actually in flat space, okay. And I would use, and basically my logic here is that you have these formulas in flat space and you derive the equivalence for the Schwinger model, and then we argue that if you want to couple this to gravity, basically by the equivalence principle, what you should do is to take this Schwinger model and couple that to gravity. And then and then the next step is to realize that this is an example of a strong weak coupling duality. And what I'm interested in is I want to see the Schwinger effect precisely for particles which have a large charge to mass ratio. That means the fermions are strongly coupled. And so therefore, that allows me to look at basically the classical limit of the boson theory. So in order to describe the quantum physics of strongly coupled fermions here, what I need to do is to solve the classical equations of this system here, coupled, of course, with the dilaton gravity that I had before. Okay, so that's the model that I'm going to solve. And so I basically have this coupled system, and I'm going to now simply analyze the solutions that I have to that. Now, to do that, it's simplest to use conformal gauge. And in conformal gauge, I'm going to write my gauge field in terms of a scalar, basically the only non-vanishing component And this epsilon here is, in fact, I think I have that previously. It is related to the usual tensor density. It is actually a tensor. It's a tensor density divided by the square root of the determinant of the metric. And so this F here will be a scalar. If you plug this now in to the equations of motion, what you find is that the Maxwell equations are very simple. They tell us that basically both the D plus and D minus, in both null directions, this has to be a derivative has to vanish, which tells us that we can, in fact, express F in terms of the bosonized matter field and the dilaton in this way. There's an integration constant here, and that if you compare this to the classical limit, which I'll do later on, what you'll see is that the interpretation of this Q here is sort of a background charge that's sitting at the strong coupling end of the world. And I will put that, since I will be later on, I'll look at gravitational collapse solutions into the vacuum, and for those it's natural to put this guy equal to zero. And furthermore, when we look at the semi-classical equation, you'll see that any integer Q can be absorbed into this vacuum. So I'm not going to worry too much about it. In fact, I will set this Q to zero. Now, so this takes care of the Maxwell equations. I still have the remaining equations of motion, which are the dilaton equation of motion, the gravitational equations, which are basically the come from the trace of the Einstein equations, and then I have constraints that come from the other two Einstein equations. And then, of course, I have the matter field equation of motion. That's the one up here. So I get this system here, and what I've done also is to so I define a new variable, which is basically the area of the transverse two sphere. So it's a nice, it both simplifies the equations, and also it's nice to be working directly with that. Like I said, it's easy to interpret the equations, the solution, sorry. And then I replace the conformal factor by this combination here, and that's just to simplify the equation. So you see, this is a pretty, it's a nonlinear system, but it's not so bad. It has all the derivatives but just plain Laplacians here. And this is flat space Laplacians because I'm already in conformal gauge. And then I have some potential terms that are somewhat messy. But, okay. So this, these are the equations that I want to solve. And let me first look at static solutions. And then, which are sort of corresponding to the Rice and Nordstrom solution that I showed you before, and then towards the end, I will show you results for solving this as a dynamical system, sending in some initial matter into control, basically studying gravitational collapse. Okay, so in a static solution, I will simply look for solutions that describe the matter field, the dilaton, or this area function, and the metric. Conformal factor here. Now, I was in conformal gauge, so this I take this combination here. This gives me the spatial variable outside the metrizon. Now, again, it's convenient to change variables, and you'll see in a minute why I want to do this. I basically, on the previous slide, I had these exponentials here. I want to do a change of variables that will get rid of those so that I'll have just polynomials on the right-hand side. And at least in the gravitational variables. Remember that the V here was it's a Sine-Gordon model, so this is a trigonometric function here of the matter field. So if I write my e to the theta as c, and I change variables in the equations in this way here, I get this system here, which is now where the dot is a derivative with respect to this new spatial variable y. So now I just want to solve these equations. And one thing to note that if I want to solve them inside the event horizon, remember that my metric flips sign, and so then these space derivatives here will change sign of all the left hand sides. Okay. So let me first look at the classical system. Now, this classical system is obtained from the previous one. It clearly is a lot simpler. And it's, if we go back, basically, if we go back a couple of slides, we saw that we could express the gauge field in terms of this field z here and e to the 2 phi. And if you remember what the solution for the original black hole looked like, in fact, what z here is playing is really playing the role of charge. And that's also reasonable because if you remember that the current in the bosonized, once you've bosonized the system, the current is in fact given by derivative of Z. So when you integrate the current, you get the charge. And so basically, the interpretation that is that Z over root pi is the total charge that's to the left of where you are in the solution. Okay? And so, therefore, in a classical black hole, this charge, of course, is constant. So you will set Z equal to a constant. And furthermore, if we take this charge to be integer, then it turns out that that amounts to sitting at a minimum of this periodic potential in the Sine-Gordon model. And the minimum of the potential is actually zero. We adjusted it such a way because we want the zero field to have zero energy. And so therefore, all the potential terms, in fact, go away if you do this. So that's why this classical system is so much simpler. I set this equal to root pi q, where q is an integer, and then the system reduces to this.
It doesn't look like z equals constant is a consistent solution of those equations, though. So you're dropping some charge?
I'm dropping the equation of motion for the particle, because that's the one that's describing the pair creation, which is no longer included if you're doing a classical system. Right, so I drop this equation here, and then in the remaining equations, I put z equal to a constant.
Is there some way of seeing that that's small? If this is semi-classical?
No, it's of course, in a strong electric field, it's not small. But that's my claim at the beginning, is that there's a large effect here that needs to be included if you're in a strong electric field.
Oh, I see.
Okay. I'm just formally, what I'm doing, just formally just showing you how you recover the classical system. And the point is that then I'm going to show you the how different the solutions are. And in particular, they differ in the region where the inner horizon used to be. Okay. And so these are easy to solve now because you find that the area function is in fact just linear. And the rest of the system is easily solved. In fact, here's your solution, and I've arranged to have it such that, and it's an unfortunate thing I've done here. It looks okay in the paper. It's actually in gray. You have to really squint to see it. So maybe if you turn the light off, we'll see it better. Sorry about that. This is no, there is more lights, okay?
Don't give up.
That's just
all
right.
So behind on the other.
No, on the other slide. My son will work for that.
Okay. All right, can you see it now? But basically, the field C here is dropping. It goes to zero at the outer horizon. Remember, C includes the conformal factor. E to the theta was 2 rho minus 2 theta. And so if E to the 2 rho is going to zero, then this C should go to zero. So that's what we use as boundary conditions in this in finding the solution. So it goes to zero at the outer horizon. And you then find that, just continue solving. Now, when you go inside, there were this sign flip in the solutions. And it turns out the only thing that happens at the level of the solution, you can sort of see that in these equations, is that you have to, at the same time that you flip the sign of your kinetic terms, you have to flip the sign of C itself. And so that's why you have this. It goes up here, and of course the conformal factor should be positive inside the black hole, so that always is working. And then it comes back down to zero. And this is the inner horizon, and you get that the area is still finite there, and then the area goes to zero, that's where you get your curvature singularity, and the conformal factor blows up, which you can see it. Yeah. And so basically this is a very nice coordinate system which allows you to exhibit all three regions of the solution. Basically, it's not the standard Kruskal extension because that, of course, keeps the metric finite going through here, but it does give you the extension of the solution. Okay. And there's this parameter here, alpha, and that is actually not, doesn't really affect the geometry, it just is setting the scale of, basically, you can absorb it by a rescaling of y. Okay? So let's see what happens in the semi-classical case. Well, then, unfortunately, I'm not able to give you analytic solutions, but it's straightforward to integrate these things numerically. And what we'll do is to set up the integration so that we will get a solution that's smooth at the outer horizon. Okay? And the way we do that is basically we are going to start at y equal to 0. That's the outer horizon. Or we'll define y equal to 0 to be there. Our black hole geometry is going to be parameterized by the values that the dilaton, or this area function, and the matter field take there. And then I will go back to the semi-classical equations, which are here. And since I will demand that c is equal to 0, that's the condition for a horizon, and I want these things to be regular, that means that I have to, if I put c equal to 0, and in a regular solution, that means this term here and this one here will go to 0. And then I just have to make sure that I choose my initial conditions for the derivatives of z and derivatives of psi in such a way that I solve the equation. Okay. And so if I do that, and for simplicity, I've actually taken the fermion mass to be 0 so that the potential is absent. Basically, the condition that the charge to mass ratio be large for the original fermion means that since I'm using units where the charge is 1, it just means I should look at very small masses. And the solutions will not change qualitatively for small values of m. So let me just keep things simple. And so this procedure fixes for me what z prime, z dot, and psi dot are. Now you still, looks like you have this free parameter here, which is psi dot at naught. But that actually is just sets the scale of the y-coordinate. It comes into the solutions in exactly the same way as this alpha here. So alpha is actually 1 over phi, or it is related to that. So it doesn't affect the geometry, it just sets the scale of your coordinate system. So therefore, you have here a complete set of initial values to do your start integrating. And so the result is here, and again, I'm showing you the classical here to compare. Maybe we should dim the lights again to see the metric. So this is the classical solution that we had before. And here is a semi-classical solution that basically starts with the value of z set here so that I have the same charge inside the black hole as I did here. The dilaton, or the area function, takes the same value also. And then I simply solve the system. And what I find is that, to begin with, first of all, what we find is that this matter field here is not constant. This is the effect of the pair creation. And basically what you find is that the black hole charge is being screened by the particles that you form. And so you're spreading out the black hole charge, if you like. And let me first discuss the interior here. Basically, this keeps going down. And then when you look at the equations, what you find is that when xi, the metric function, starts approaching 0, it actually drives the other two functions to 0 also. And this is what we find. And instead of having, basically, a smooth inner horizon is one where xi goes to 0 and the other guys are still finite. In principle, we could have plotted a constant z here as the constant charge of the black hole. And this is not what we get here. This, in fact, goes down. And if you look at it, the Ricci scalar actually is increasing rather rapidly when you're approaching this. So, of course, this is a numerical solution, so you can't say that we've definitively found a singularity, although it's hard to see how you could avoid it, because if you look at the equations, in fact, both psi and c in this region have to be concave. It's easily seen from the equations. Remember, you have to flip the sides here. And it's very easy to see that psi double dot has to be negative, and in fact, psi double dot is also negative. Once you flip the sign over here. Okay? And so that means you cannot, once this thing starts going down, there's no way they can recover and bend up again. Okay? We can look at this in slightly more detail. Let me come back to this. Basically, if you look at the semi-classical equations, you can try to find the solution near the singular point. And what we found was this set of scaling solutions. So they don't actually solve the equations exactly what they do is they're sort of they're solving to leading. They're solving up to remainders that are small compared to the terms that cancel. So these are that's why I call them scaling solutions. And it's a two-parameter family of them. And what they are actually is if you take the neutral black hole, and this is perhaps not surprising, you take the neutral black hole and in fact you get some logarithmic corrections to it. In particular, if you look at the parameters here, the power here of the logarithmic correction involved is in the absence of this Z field which is carrying the charge, you would get no correction at all. Okay? And so if we assume for the moment that this is the solution that you approach near the singular point, so this, I'm arguing, this basically is as you approach this point here, this is what we call minus y naught, then you get something that looks more or less like a neutral black hole. You can easily see that the curvature diverges when you approach this. In fact, you can say more, you can say that the integral along any geodesic of the curvature diverges. So this is a strong singularity in that sense that the integrated tidal effect needs to diverge here. Now, in the classical mass inflation singularity, I believe, the statement is that the integrated tidal effect is actually finite when we go through the so this is definitely a stronger singularity than that. And furthermore, if you look at what the conformal factor is doing here, it's actually space-like. It's not a null singularity. Even though, of course, the C is going to zero, if you look at the conformal factor, which is you have to divide through by this psi here, you get something that actually diverges. And that is the behavior near the CGHS type singularity, the space-like one. Okay? Now, the only problem with this picture is that, unfortunately, because of the logarithms here, these solutions are really only valid extremely close to the singular point. And so we're not actually able to make contact yet, at least, between them and this numeric solution. Basically, the sort of numbers that you need in order to get into that scaling, you have to be able to solve these with, you know, we're talking about numbers like e to the minus 100. If you want to get a 1% accuracy in these scaling solutions. So we're not too hopeful that we're going to get there. But still, it's only a second-order equation, so having found the scaling solution, it's hard to see what else could be there. All right? Now, there's some further interesting things that you can see here. For example, these black holes. And this is something I failed to mention earlier.
Lars, can you see, in that scaling solution, why not with an arbitrary parameter, I guess? But yeah. When you do your numerics, is it clear that the singularity is occurring before the inner horizon of your...
Well, think about it. What the inner horizon actually means here, the inner horizon was occurring here at some value of psi.
Yeah. Right?
And whereas it's a coordinate-dependent statement, exactly where it happens. We have this freedom to scale the coordinates. Okay? And so here what's happening is that psi is going to zero and psi is actually going to zero here and not staying finite. Okay? If you were going to hit an inner horizon first, you would have to see that both z and psi would actually stay regular while psi would go to zero. So if we look at, there's an important difference between these 2D black holes and the Weissman-Nordström case, which is that this effect that I'm talking about is always strong in this system. But you can actually dial your parameters to make it a small effect in Weissman-Nordström. Although, of course, when you include the dynamics of it, there are papers that argue that including this effect, even in a weak electric field, it'll enhance the mass inflation singularity or the mass inflation effect and may cause that singularity to be stronger. There's some numerical evidence for that. But anyway, the reason this is always a strong effect comes here. If you look at the classical solution that I showed you, then this scalar here, this was the scalar measure of the electric field strength. And it went like the charge divided by the area at the horizon for a classical black hole. And if you plug in what the area is at the horizon, we had a formula for that at the That's basically was just where the metric function in the first slide had the had a zero. You'll find that this field strength is only dependent on the ratio between Q and M. Okay. And the Reisner-Nordström black hole, it is a function of that ratio, but there's also a one over M in front. And that's just because the dimensionality works out for that. But in particular, that means if you have a fixed ratio and you make the mass very large, then the electric field doesn't get strong until you're inside the inner horizon. That never happens here. Actually, the electric field is always strong. Basically of order one in these units at the inner horizon. And so if you like, we should only think of this maybe as a good model for a black hole with parameters that are such that the critical field is actually achieved around or outside the inner horizon. But it may not be quite that clear cut because of the once you have the dynamical effects like mass inflation, we may in fact get a significant effect even if the field is somewhat weaker. But anyway, there's something here that one can see just to see that we have the basic picture working here. Is that in the semi-classical case, well, I will take as a definition of the charge that's inside the black hole just the value of this F field over mm-hmm. pi. And this black hole should be emitting charged particles, therefore, because the electric field is actually non-vanishing outside. And if it's emitting charged particles, the particles that have the same charge as the black hole will be accelerated to infinity, the others will go in now in a static solution, and that of course would be discharge the black hole, but a static solution you will have to compensate somehow. So you have to have an incoming flux from infinity. But you can do this in one dimension. That's a state you don't have to worry about because the gravitational coupling is going to zero asymptotically. You don't have a gene sensibility in the system. And so what these static solutions are actually describing to you is not just the black hole that's sitting there, but it's actually in equilibrium with the flux that's coming in from infinity. And that flux should be basically the energy density asymptotically. And it's actually easy to see, that if you take the semi-classical equation, you can see that they will, the solutions describe, basically the Z field goes logarithmically at infinity for massless fermions. And that corresponds to precisely this having a constant asymptotic energy density in this coordinate system we're using. But the actual value is something that you have to solve for numerically. And so I've done that here. Here's a table that gives you this energy density here for some various things. And the thing you look for is that the entries in the table depend more or less only on the ratio Z over psi and not on the absolute values. So that's confirming this picture up here. And sort of the thing is hanging together. So this is all I wanted to say about static solutions. To summarize, what we're seeing is that they are singular where the classical solutions were non-singular. They're singular before you have an inner horizon. And if we accept the scaling solution as the correct behavior near the singularity, then we can say something more. We can study how strongly the curvature diverges and so on. But of course, a more physically interesting situation is when we look at gravitational collapse. So let me briefly describe to you how we approach that. We basically had dynamical equations for time-dependent solutions, and now we are going to put them on a computer and solve. And I'm not going to tell you anything about the details of how we do this. Basically, this is the configuration that we start with. We take matter profile, and I'm going to look at a kink because a kink is carries net charge. Remember the charge. It's now zero inside here, and then there's some finite charge that's, so this is basically the Z field here. And then we're going to send this in this way. Okay. And I'm going to work in coordinates. Again, this is fairly conformal coordinates here. And I'm going to do a further conformal transformation that actually brings the point at infinity to a finite point here. And so what I'll show you, the results we get, it's nice that we can do this because basically the program will spit out the Penrose diagram directly, which is nice. So this is what you have in this such a coordinate system if you just start with a vacuum. And by the way, the way we need to solve the equations, of course, we need initial values. The initial values are now determined first by, basically we give you this value here, And there's a residual gauge feed and then the conformal gauge where you can do separate coordinate transformations on B and U. And we use that basically to free them to pick any, just a convenient, we can use that to fix the area function on an initial slice here to be any convenient monotonic function. That basically defines the coordinate system for us. We then solve for the remainder for the C function, the conformal factor, by solving the constraint equation here. The plus plus constraint over here, the minus minus over here. And we insert into the constraint equation this kink configuration for the incoming matter, and of course we say that we have vacuum here. And this gives us, this completely determines for us the initial data. So so the results are here. This is what the vacuum looks like in the absence of anything coming in. And this is a density plot, so a dark color means a high value. Strictly speaking, of course, it goes to infinity, so we don't quite get the Penrose diagram. We have to cut this off here. And then a weak going to zero is the white here, so there will be infinite. As you know, in the linear delta vacuum, the coupling is actually infinite here. But that's infinitely far away also. Okay. So now let's see what happens when we send in the field. So in this case, what you get is different. You find that the place where it becomes white is actually bends over like this. So basically, the matter comes in here. There's a horizon that forms. We plot that for you here, apparent horizon, and then there's a singularity. And I don't think there's any doubt that this is a space-like singularity. And furthermore, because we're able to follow the solutions all the way up to conformal infinity, we see that there's really no room for the classical picture is that there's a null portion here of the singularity, which is sort of the singular version of the quotient horizon. But that seems to have been completely eliminated here. Okay? But of course, the difference is that not, this picture, of course, includes the finger effect, the percolation effect, which the other one did not. Okay. The matter field is similarly here. This describes the kink that comes in. The matter field is zero here, and then it rather quickly rises to its asymptotic value. And here you see thing that, which is familiar from the old studies of the linear delta electrodynamics, which is what happens is when you bosonize, you get basically this bosonized field develops a mass which is proportional to the strength of the coupling. And so it actually cannot penetrate into the strong coupling region. And you see that quite well here, that it is expelled from that region, but it gets inside the event horizon, so you do get a black hole that carries a charge. But this charge, as you can see, you can see that the field is getting smaller along the horizon as you go, and that's the fact that this is now a dynamic situation. There's nobody feeding charge in from the outside, so these black holes will discharge themselves slowly over time. Okay. And here's the curvature. And in fact, the curvature variations are so large that we plot for you the arctangent of the curvature. And so again, it's weak, of course, in the asymptotic region. There's no curvature in the vacuum before the matter comes in. And then here's your curvature singularity. This white line here is actually where the curvature goes negative and large. There's an oscillation that occurs. And we can look at that curvature a little bit more detail. You go in, what I'm going to show you next is a profile in the curvature going in along with one of these null lines here. And because the curvature gets extremely large towards the end, what we plot for you here is the inverse curvature. Okay, so here we are going along one of those lines into the black hole. The curvature is getting very large. Now, one nice thing about the numerics here is that we use the constraints to actually define for us initial data, but the actual algorithm for solving the equation does not use the constraint equation. And as a result, we can see how well the constraints are satisfied, and when our numerical errors have added up, that a very good indicator of that is whether the constraints are well satisfied or not. And it turns out that they're actually quite well satisfied through here, and this is where there's sort of a breaking down. So there really seems to be a real effect that the curvature is oscillating, with a rather going from a huge amplitude oscillation here. And this is not, it's apparently quite common. Close to singularities in numerical. Okay. Now we've just to finish. There's some other effects you can study here. Here's a preliminary study of some sort of Chaptuic-like scaling in this system. what we're plotting here is the amplitude, it's the log-log plot of the amplitude of your pulse that goes in to the value of the area on the apparent horizon. And then it shows a nice slope here, which is telling us that we have the scaling exponent here, that we haven't measured it very precisely, but it's actually it's a larger value of the scaling exponent than what you see in the usual three-person dimensional system. And the domain, sort of an aside, the main conclusion that we're drawing is that in these dynamical solutions, there's no sign of an inner horizon or a null singularity inside these black holes. Now, clearly what we'd like to do is to resolve this approach to the static, to the singularity in the static solution better. Another thing that we're working on is to actually, this is a very nice simple model to study mass inflation, so we're in fact working out the equations to run the program just for a classical evolution moving a scalar field. We should be able to see very explicitly this mass inflation and not by studying perturbations on top of an existing Rasmussen black hole or existing charge black hole here, but really do the thing from scratch, send in some charge scalar field and see what we get. Another thing that's should be relatively straightforward is to include the gravitational quantum corrections here, which is what CGHS model did and its relatives. And that actually might be also interesting if we want to explore this scaling behavior a little more, because once we include the Hawking effect, you actually do get a threshold for black hole formation, which is what we don't have that at the classical level here. So there will be a minimal mass black hole that you will form in that case. And then you can study this. And also these are, once you include the charged black holes, you get more interesting possibilities for this scaling, because for the neutral CGHS black holes, they all have the same Hawking temperature. So here actually you have Hawking temperature that varies as a function of the charge to mass ratio of the black hole. And it means you expect, basically, if they all have the same Hawking temperature, it meant that there was a unique mass threshold in this. This was studied by myself and Andy Schrominger 10 years ago. And so basically, you should get a much richer sort of parameter. Set of parameters to study these scaling issues. And at the same time, both the numerics and the analytic approach to these models is much simpler than the spherically reduced gravity. But, of course, I didn't even include it on here, but what we are also working on is to try to look at analogous issues in more realistic systems. In particular, we'd like to think about rotating black holes. For that, we will have to leave two dimensions. And we have been thinking about how to explore these effects in the context of EADS CMT correspondence, but we don't have any results on that yet. But that seems like a promising place to look, because there you have, after all, a quantum mechanical description, which should, in principle, on the gauge theories that already include this effect if you have charged matter in it. So, thank you.
Describe your dynamical collapse.
Uh-huh.
You're including semi-classical corrections in the equations of motion.
Absolutely.
So do these black holes have Hawking radiation?
No, sorry. They have Schwingen radiation. What we're including is only the quantum effect of the charged matter.
Okay.
What we're not including is energy loss due, for example, to gravitational you should be able to see the dilaton field also carrying. And that's what you see in the CGHS.
So in your dynamical things, the black hole loses charge?
It loses charge and mass also, because, of course, these charged particles can also lose mass. But it actually loses mass much very slowly, because it turns out because these particles have a large mass to charge to mass ratio, of course, they carry very efficiently away the charge, much more efficiently than the mass. So the final state that you get there will be a neutral black hole of finite mass.
finite mass neutral bulk.
And so, and if I, and then the point that is, if I include the Hawking effect, of course, it will completely evaporate. Okay. And you can play with the parameters to make the two sort of competitive in rate or. But of course, you cannot really trust these classical equations for the bosonic matter unless the charge to mass ratio is large. And formally, it should be approaching infinity.
Any other questions? Let's thank the speaker again.